I wonder if today, looking at the announcements, I was thinking that maybe the function of the announcements for me is to get me talking. Because sometimes after I sit, I don't feel like talking. And in fact, there was once on a Thursday, we were back in Palo Alto, where we rang the bell to end the sitting, and I didn't talk. Was anybody here for that time? Anybody here that you were there that day? What was that like when I didn't talk? But I waited about 15 minutes before I said that.
Yeah.
What?
It was neat because we just expected, you know, it was really
eye-opening. So I didn't know what to expect either, but I sat there and I didn't feel like I needed to say anything or wanted to say anything. And so I sat there, and after a while, they're sitting there in silence for a while. It was clear that something was happening in the silence, so I just let it be. And after some time, I don't know how long it was, but then I said finally something like that, or, you know, if you're waiting for something to happen, then you've missed the boat. And then we had more silence, and then people started talking, asking questions, I think, and we then had a discussion at the end. And so because of the announcements, I can't do that. But I did last week here, Monday night, talk about papancha, the tendency for the mind to proliferate and obsess with thoughts. And I made reference to how the Buddha talked about once these obsessing thoughts kind of get the upper hand and churn away, they in return attack us. And we can feel assailed by them. And as I'm sitting here now, the contrast to a mind that's obsessed with proliferating thoughts and obsessions and churning of mind, it's a silence. And I'm very fond of silence. And sometimes I think, you know, we should just sit in silence more. I've told a story recently. I apologize if it was recently for all of you. The first time I came into the center, was this very recently? Was it last Monday I told this? Forget. The first time I came in here was about 2 years ago now. It would be 2 years ago, I guess, the beginning of September, end of August. And we had been talking with the ministers about buying this church for some time. And I guess for about 8 months or so. But we'd never been inside. We just had these conversations on the phone. And they wanted to sell it to us. And they were pretty much set on selling it to us, I think. But they hadn't really showed it to us yet. And after about 8 months of this wonderful telephone conversations with these wonderful mystical Christians, they were going to show it to us. And I came an hour early before the board and other people were going to come and see the building for the first time. And I met them on the street out there. And they were lovely people and elderly. And then they did the commonsensical thing. They brought me in here to do a tour of the building. And I didn't think about it until really afterwards, in a sense. But for as we were going around talking about the building, there would be pauses in the conversation, the silence. And that silence, those pauses became longer and longer. Until finally we came in here. And there were the pews all lined up here, and there was kind of a cross up there above Glenn. And there was, and so we sat down in the front pews, and we had one of our these pauses in the conversation. And I think we paused maybe about 10 or 15 minutes. And then someone came in, one of the board members, I think, came in because it was time for the board members to come, and so they were showing up. And so then we just got up from our seats. And then at some point I went over to the ministers and said to him, whispered to him and said, "Oh, someday we'll have to pick up where we left off." And that sitting there with them in silence was actually probably the most significant or very powerful part of that meeting with them. It was very rich, very pregnant, very, you know, very strong sense of presence, and the fact that we're really together in a way that we couldn't have been together, I think, if we kept talking. I really loved it, and they loved it, I think, and it just was a natural thing to do. I suspect that someone could write a dictionary about all the meanings of silence, all the different kinds of silences. You know, the silent treatment, the silencing of, there's kind of silencing of women, for example. There's all this stuff all around silence. Sometimes silence is very frightening for people, it's very oppressive for some people, the way silence manifests itself. But one of the aspects of silence is the silence of, I don't know what to call it, spiritual silence, or the silence of the soul, or the silence of emptiness, or the silence of... There's a kind of silence that can be a kind of wellspring of energy, a wellspring of inspiration, wellspring of health and healing, or wellspring of joy, or wellspring of kind of feeling at home, or feeling well, or feeling kind of a depth of life. And I wonder how many of us give ourselves time to be with that silence, to appreciate it, to love it, to make it possible to happen. Sometimes it doesn't take much, but sometimes much is what it takes for the mind to be silenced to some degree. There's an expression in English called to have one's breath taken away. And I think one of the consequences of having a breath taken away, something amazing happens, is the usual thoughts and concerns we had leading up to that moment of experience are usually quieted, silenced. Maybe become irrelevant or just become seeming so trivial and mundane and in relationship to them, whatever it has been. But sometimes the immensity, the awe, you step in into the middle of the Sierras and it takes your breath away sometimes, the view. Someone's dying, you walk into someone's room and they're dying and it kind of takes your breath away. Things changes a lot very quickly. Or someone's just died. Or someone's been born. The silence after someone has died is quite something at times. And it's been said, I think, by many people that our culture, our modern culture, doesn't have much place for silence in it. It's not like, we don't have built-in silence, do we? We try, you know, our culture tries everything it can to fill the silences. And you go to, you know, all kinds of places and they have music going. And people turn on the music at home and when there's silence. And some people are oppressed or afraid of silence, afraid of being alone. And so they have music, to kind of radio or whatever, to fill the space. And there's a kind of strong momentum for many people in our culture to always be doing, to be doing activities and engaged in many, many things. And it's almost as if the busyness sometimes precludes the possibility of experiencing the silence, which is deep inside. I think when you really feel a silence, maybe it doesn't even make sense to say it's deep inside, but the silence. When I was a Zen student for a number of years, I remember we had to have these interviews with a teacher. And their Zen interviews are kind of formal. And you come in and you have to do these bows. First you do a standing bow as you get in through the door, and then you do a full bow to the Buddha, perhaps, and then you go do either a standing bow or a full bow to the teacher. And so this whole ritual, it takes a while to get in there. You don't just kind of show up and say, you know, how are you, and how's the weather? But, you know, after a while, you do all this very, very formal kind of paying of respect. And then you sit down in meditation posture, and you sit there and make yourself settled and composed, and then the interview starts. And for many times, I found that I didn't want to speak. I valued the meeting, the interview. But the sense I had was that if I said anything, there would be a loss of integrity. And so it was enough just to sit there. But it was a little bit awkward, too. I remember that story about when silence was... it's a little bit tangential, but how many of you know Stephen Gaskin? You know Stephen Gaskin? Stephen Gaskin was a ex-Marine sergeant, ex-Marine, who dropped a lot of acid in the 60s. And he was teaching English at San Francisco State and started holding these called Monday night classes and became kind of one of the great gurus of the psychedelic generation. And at some point he got into a school bus, and all the other school buses joined him, and there's a whole caravan of school buses going across the country of hippies. And they ended up settling in Tennessee at a commune called The Farm. And when I visited, there were 800 people living there in this commune. And by that time, they'd been busted for drugs and stuff. And they had decided that they didn't need to do acid anymore. They had found a better way. And that they found that honesty was more powerful than acid. So they dropped the acid. But so Stephen Gaskin was in jail when I came there. And I spent a couple of months there with him still in jail he took the rap for the community. And when he came out, I remember the first time I met him. I went over to introduce myself, and I said, you know, I'm like, I'm Gil, and I'm new here. And I expected him to say something like, oh, that's nice, and, you know, where you're from, and, you know, something, you know, some kind of, you know, question. And there was no question. And I was met by this silence. But the silence was this man looking at me with his eyes, and me looking at him in his eyes. And the next thing that happened was that my mind exploded. And it just exploded. It started going out into space, just, you know, into black space, kind of beautiful, luminous kind of space. It's going out and out and out. And then it was pretty amazing. But then I realized that, you know, this guy was there, and you know, you're supposed to have a conversation. You're supposed to say something, you know, some social niceties or something. And so I contracted and came back. And that was over, that trip. And what would have happened if I hadn't been caught up in the social conventions, the ideas, the fear of, you know, is this person going to like me? Do I need to say something here? And, you know, if I just kept going, what would have happened? So, you know, not being comfortable with silence. It's a quite common phenomenon, not common, but at a certain depth of meditation, it's relatively common that people feel afraid of either what's just happened, some experience of silence or stillness or emptiness, or they feel up against the edge of it and they feel, oh, I can't go there, it's too much. I won't exist there, is one fear. I'll die in some ways. I mean, this isn't exactly a physical death, but, you know, the ego will die. You know, do we really want our ego to die? The ego doesn't usually want to, so he pulls back. So pulling back from the depth of silence, it's possible. I see one of the things that kind of inspired this talk was I've seen it just very, very powerfully in my own meditation at home, sitting. How when I sit down to meditate, even here when I sat with you tonight, that I'll sit down and compose myself and get started with my meditation. And after about 5 minutes, I realize that mostly I've just been thinking. And so, I need to get serious here. And so then, but there becomes this point in my meditation where I kind of make a choice, or I can make a choice, between where I'd rather be with my attention. Would I rather kind of let myself keep drifting back into that world of thoughts? Or would I rather choose something else, rather than kind of drifting in my thoughts and concerns? And I've done enough meditation now to know that there's something much more valuable for me, much more deeply satisfying and much more important than allowing myself to wander and drift aimlessly in my thoughts and concerns and plans and wonderings and things that can happen. And so there's a shift away from that towards a kind of silence, towards a kind of silencing of at least the mind is very busy and caught up in thoughts. And it's exquisite. It's really pleasant. I really love it. And even though it's so pleasant, so satisfying or so profound or something appropriate or something like that, there's still this these threads, these Velcro, these little things, you know, creeping up and, you know, grabbing my attention and pulling me back into this, you know, into the world of thoughts and ideas. And it's like a superficial mind kind of creeps in, like creepers, like plant creepers that creep in, you know. And for a while I had to keep cutting away the creepers. I had to keep cutting away those plants that are creeping in. Turning away or letting go of them or having a little more resolve to stay with the meditation. And then at some point, the concentration kind of starts, in a sense, where the mind gets tamed or quiets down enough so that that kind of proliferating thoughts, the kind of mind, that kind of superficial chatter of the mind, quiets down. And it becomes a lot easier to maintain that choice, to stay focused then on, for example, on the breath. And as I stay more focused on the breath, then this wonderful thing happens occasionally where it seems to be, then I'm surrounded by silence, or silence or stillness seems to be a very common phenomena of what's there. And in that stillness or that silence, the breath or a sense of presence and the mindfulness that I have of what's happening seems to become much more highlighted, much more powerful, much more much more aware of it. It becomes like, it sounds like, I wouldn't say it's louder, but it's like, becomes clearer, or more crisper, or more prominent. Prominent is a good word. And usually, if things are going well, it feels very, very satisfying to have this prominence of mindfulness, this clarity, this clear awareness of what's happening moment by moment. This constant stability of mind stays there. But I see in my own mind how much, how powerful the authority is of, seemingly authority or the allure of the mind that wants to think about things. And there has to be some wisdom in meditation about when it's useful to think, what kind of thinking is useful, and what kind of thinking to let go of, the 99.99999% of the thoughts, which in meditation are not useful for the purposes of meditation, probably not about meditation at all anyway. And to have some willingness then to say, oh, I don't have to fix my life, I don't have to organize my life, I don't have to solve my life through my thinking right now. And so to be a willingness to kind of separate ourselves, not so much from the fact of thinking, but separating ourselves from being glued to the thoughts or wedded to the thoughts or invested in our thoughts, to no longer invest ourselves in the world of thinking as if our who we are is dependent on the conclusion, the results of our thinking. So there has to be some new orientation to the world of thinking. And I think that's one of, there's many kind of revolutions that happens in the mind as people learn something like meditation. And one of them, I think, has to do with a wise relationship to our thoughts. And to know when it's useful to think, perhaps, when it's useful to think and be engaged in it. I love thinking. It's a fond thing. I'm fond of it. But also, thinking assails me and attacks me. Sometimes it's completely ridiculous. And I know that at times it keeps me from this depth of silence and stillness that is available. So there has to be a willingness to turn away, a willingness to let go of the investment into this. And that's really fascinating to explore, how we're invested in our thoughts, how we invest ourselves in the world of our thinking, that, we think it's going to do something for us, subconsciously, perhaps unconsciously. What is it we think the thoughts are going to do for us? We wouldn't be so glued to them unless we really thought they were going to do something really important for us. And part of the path of meditation is to realize that perhaps that there's something really valuable that can happen to you when you dissolve that glue. And when you don't try to negotiate your life through thoughts anymore. And so the one kind of meditation exercise that some teachers will give is to, in your meditation, look for the silence between your thoughts. What is that silence like? And who are you in the silence between your thoughts? There's no one there thinking. There's no one there having words telling you who you are. Because then you're out of the silence, right? So there's no one there to tell you. You're not there to tell yourself who you are. So who are you when you're not there to tell yourself who you are? You haven't died yet, so you're still just fine, I think. But for some people, that's a frightening place. It's a challenging place because, oh, it's disorienting. Oh, if I'm not telling myself who I am, then what's going on? I think a part of the deepest silence that can come from meditation comes from a mind which is not relating to anything. Maybe that's a very poor way of trying to express what I want to express. But when the attention, when the mind, when our thoughts, it's usually focused on something. It's usually concerned about something. It's usually relating to something. So some of you are now listening to what I'm saying. So you're focused on this. You're relating to my words. Or maybe you're relating to your thoughts about what I've said. Maybe something's triggered something inside of you. And so you're thinking about your thoughts. Or maybe your emotions, your feelings. Maybe you're inspired. Or maybe you're depressed about this. I'll talk about silence and whatever, you know, bored. And so you're relating to that. It's about that. That's what's going on. Or maybe you're thinking about tomorrow or thinking about the television program you missed because you came here. You know, there's always things, your mind's thinking about something. It's engaged. It's relating to something. And there's a surface concerns, which are quite easy to see. But underneath the surface chatter of the mind, there are very strong, powerful currents of the mind relating to something. Our deepest concern, our deepest worry. So some people, for example, being in relationship to other people is one of their deepest concerns. And underneath the surface chatter of the mind, even when that quiets down, scanning the horizon for to be in relationship to other people is, you know, such a primary thing that the mind does. Or maybe a sense of security. So the mind looking out for security, trying to find security. Or the mind is, you know, a very deep level of the mind is concerned with boosting its ego, boosting itself, being someone, being a self, identity. So in the depth of meditation, there's an experience of the mind where the mind is not relating to anything. The mind is freed from always looking. It's not about something. It's not thinking about something or engaged in something or looking outside of itself or looking inside of itself towards something. The mind is not towards something or away from anything. The mind is not relating to anything. Now, that can be disturbing to some people to hear, the possibility. But it's, or that, you know, but that's an innate ability that the mind has. The mind can be luminous or self-luminous. The mind can be, it's said that in Buddhism sometimes that the mind is luminous by itself, except for the visitors that defile it or cover it or taint it. So in its essence, in a sense in Buddhism, it seems as if the mind is luminous, self-luminous, the mind which is not relating to anything. It's almost as if when the mind relates to something, it covers the luminosity of the mind. If we use different kind of language, some very deep sense of presence, deep, satisfying, still sense of presence, you might feel yourself kind of leaving it, kind of lifting yourself up out of it, perhaps, or contracting away from it when you start relating to something. I'll give you another silent story. Then again, I apologize for saying this before. Some years ago, I was teaching a retreat. It was actually a Catholic convent. And so it was a Buddhist retreat, a silent retreat for 10 days. 2 weeks it was. And there was a woman there who was quite disturbed. She had a lot of anxiety, a lot of worry about all kinds of things, and very much involved in the world of thoughts, and really didn't see any way out of it, didn't know there was anything outside of that. And was only trying to negotiate the world in her thoughts. And it's kind of like being stuck in a maze. If you're only trying to do things inside the world of thoughts, there's no way out, ultimately. And a very troubled woman, very much in conflict with herself and people around her. And we had this morning sitting. Both of us were there at the morning sitting. It was a beautiful sitting. I think it was a guided meditation, which really helps people get really settled and quiet. And after that meditation, immediately afterwards, I had an interview with her. So I left the hall to go upstairs to this little nun's room. It's a very sweet little room, Santa Sabina. I don't know if you know it. And it's beautiful. And, you know, I love these little monastic cells. It's my hope, one of my hopes, kind of like some ideals or dreams, is kind of like to die in a room like that. So we sat there, and the light was coming in. And we both showed up. I was sitting there, and she came to sit next to me. And we were so filled with the meditation and the stillness and silence of the meditation that we just sat there kind of, I don't know how I was, but I shouldn't talk to myself, but she was sitting there glowing. And she was so much at ease and at peace. And it felt like there was nothing we needed to say. And I was just in awe that she had come to that. I didn't know she had the ability for that. And it was just like so beautiful to see. I knew her for many years. It was really to see this as a possibility for her. And enjoying that together, just being in that space together, it's like this communion of silence. And then she said something like, you know, this is really great. But yesterday was different. Yesterday I was, you know, having some trouble with this kind of thing and with that. And as she started telling me about yesterday, I could watch the transformation in front of my eyes of this woman who was radiant and peaceful into someone who was filled with anxiety and distress. Because she was telling me about it, recounting it, how it was yesterday. How sad I felt, you know, it was here, it was right here. But she had a mind which was so powerfully relating to something. Concerns, worries, anxieties, this kind of stuff. So the mind that doesn't relate to anything, the awareness doesn't relate to anything. In the Buddhist tradition, in the early Buddhist tradition, that experience of tasting the stillness, the silence of the mind that doesn't relate to anything, is said to be something you touch with your body. I love that expression. They touched it with the body. You touch it with your body. So it's not something just with the mind, but something embodied sense, something that kind of fills you, maybe fills your body. Something physical almost, a physical sense of, maybe in a very different kind of spiritual tradition, you'd say a physical sense of presence. But a kind of stillness, which is almost like a force or a power or a stillness or a freedom. So the question I'd like to leave you all with is two things. Do you, in the course of your days and weeks and months, give yourself quality time to be in silence? Do you have access or ways of being in silence with others or by yourself, going in the woods or sitting and looking out the window? Or do you have some ways to really allow silence to nourish you? Are there ways that silence can really nourish you? And if there is those ways, if you know those ways, I would encourage you maybe to consider that nourishment is probably worth a lot more than some of the other things you do for nourishment or for entertainment or for pleasure or for... But we so often sacrifice the deep satisfaction of silence for a lot of things. Television. So that's one question. You know, do you have that access? Do you take the time? And I encourage you to make that time. And the second is, in your meditation practice, can you look and sense, feel your way into the silence there in an appreciative way, in a way that brings you a kind of sense of satisfaction or joy? The satisfying silence that's already there, we could say. And can you feel your way? Can you sense your way? Can you listen your way? Can you taste your way into that silence? Can you touch your way into it? Can you do that little bit of decision-making, analysis, consideration, where you realize, oh, these thoughts that I have, I think it's okay to let them be for now. I don't have to be engaged in them. Put them down, let them rest, not for now. To be inspired or to have the wisdom, the understanding that that the solution for your life maybe is not going to be found by thinking. And so maybe for a little bit you can put that aside. And having that consideration might make it a little bit easier to do that. But if you don't have some serious wisdom or understanding or appreciation of this little point, it's all too easy then to be swept up over and over again by your thoughts. Because somehow in the psyche, maybe even subconsciously, thinks, oh, this is really important to think right now. This is the most important thing I should has to happen right now is thinking about, and you fill in the blank.
Bill?
Yes.
When you experience the silence in meditation, aren't you then thinking about the silence, relating to the silence?
When you go into the pool, the question is, when you experience the silence and you're aware of the silence, aren't you then thinking about the silence? It can be. There are very powerful sense of presence or silence that it doesn't preclude the possibility of thinking about it. It's just a little small little voice in the mind that kind of says, "Oh, there's real deep silence here." So there's layers of silence. This thing where your breath's taken away, you see something really immense, and the mind gets really still, and you can kind of have some reflection about that. It's possible. That's possible. But it's also possible to be aware of that silence without thinking. So if you go, for example, on a hot day and lower yourself into a refreshing pool of water, are you aware that you're in the water without thinking about that you're in the water? Did you hear the laughter when you said that in the room?
That I'm always thinking, yeah.
Did you hear the laughter in the room?
Yes.
Did you think about that laughter when you heard it?
Yes.
You did. Thoughts are fast.
I've never experienced the silence.
Uh-huh. It's also partly a matter of degree. So you might look a little bit at your mind at the degree of that possibility, because I'm sure you have to some degree. So you might look at the degree. And it might be most obvious when the mind is obsessing about something, really caught up and churning away, and versus some time when it's not that, when you feel more at rest and at ease with the world. A friend of mine who is a very good meditator said once that he was in a conflict with someone, very serious conflict about something, and it took him 6 months before his meditation could get really still again. Because that little conflict was kept pulling him in. So that points to something, another thing maybe I should say, is that it's one thing to talk about, like I talked about today, about going into meditation and putting aside your thoughts and going into the silence as if it's an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do for many people, or most of the time for most people. And sometimes other things are needed as a preliminary or as a support for that, as a possibility. And so, for example, when there's a lot of anger or resentment, perhaps a process of forgiveness is necessary. Or perhaps resolving some issue is necessary. Going and talking to someone we have issues with. Certain things, we need to, there's all kinds of ways. A spiritual life includes a lot more than just sitting in meditation. It also means taking care of other things. Today I had a conversation with someone who wrote a dissertation on right speech. And I told her my little story about the thought exercise I teach sometimes, where I say, imagine yourself in a, you've gone on a nice hike, and it's been a beautiful spring day and the grass is green and you had a wonderful little lunch and you had a nice nap and you woke up and you're under the oak tree and just beautiful weather, just the right temperature, and you just feel so refreshed, and you're next to your friends laying next to you, and you turn to your friend and you lie. And how does that feel? And probably in the context of being so calm, so peaceful, the lie feels like a real transgression. But then now in contrast, imagine yourself on Highway 101 at 5 o'clock, it's rush hour traffic, you're late for some really important meeting, and people are cutting you off, and there's smogs, and your air conditioner doesn't work, and you're getting more and more irritated and hot, and one person one more time cuts you off, and how quickly it is, we'll say something or do something with a finger or something. The quality of our mind is what I told this woman today on the phone, was the quality of our mind affects a lot the decisions we make about how we express ourselves, and affects our ethical decisions even. And her response, she said, great, she liked that. And then she said, yes, but it's not just the quality of your mind, because I'd use the word mind. It also has to do with, it depends a little bit on your physical condition. And, you know, if you don't take care of your body, how can you expect, you know, your mind, or you know, you need to take care of your body also. And so you need to do something like yoga, or, you know, go for walks, or do something for your body. The Buddha, you know, was a big-time walker. That's what he did. I don't. There's no evidence that he did any exercise. But he did a lot of walking. And walking is a great toner for the body. And so again, so if a person's only relying on meditation and not doing the appropriate things to take care of their body, and just a minimal, so the body's well-toned and the energy goes smoothly in their body, it's very hard then to do the kind of deeper work that comes. So there's a whole range of things that support this possibility. Yes.
Is it ever possible to meditate with the intent to have some sort of something, you know, like if you have some decision you need to make about your career, or you know, something that you need to find a way to, you know, are you meditating, is that then your thinking? Is it possible to have the intent and have a meditation?
Well, there's so many different kinds of meditation. There's like a whole big array of what meditation is. And so there are forms of meditation that are more contemplative in nature, that actually involve reflection and using thoughts in helpful ways. We don't want to make thoughts the enemy in any kind of way. And thoughts have their role in spiritual life for sure. And there are ways of meditating where we put thoughts aside completely and we're not going to be engaged in them at all. And there are forms of meditation where we actually use them for deep reflection or even decision making. And one small way of doing that, for example, is to use your meditative ability to get as quiet and still as you can. And really put aside your concern as best you can for 15, 20 minutes in meditation, or however long you can. And get as deeply still and quiet as is available to you. And then when you think you've come to some point where it makes sense to change the focus, then you bring up the topic. And maybe by having a very simple question, or you just have a word. And then let the mind begin reflecting in its own way. And sometimes the mind that's concentrated and still is much more creative in making connections and making understandings than the mind that's kind of surface chatter and worried and concerned and all that. And you can be much more productive kind of reflection when the mind is still. So that's a very wonderful thing to do.
That kind of reflection, is that what we would call thinking? Or is it dropping the thought in and then pretending it's not there, meditating and just see what pops up later?
Both can, you know, anything's possible. It's all valid. You're asking me, is it okay or something? Yeah. I can give you permission. Have fun with your meditation. Have a good time. Try different things out, and don't feel like it has to be one way. And there are some times when you might find that doing exactly what you said, just being really still and dropping a thought or the idea, and just see what bubbles up. And sometimes the mind might stay silent, and then there's a little explosion of some feeling or explosion of some thought. And you're not really engaged in thinking per se, but you've made the space for something to happen that wouldn't otherwise happen. And sometimes your mind might pick it up as a theme, and you think about it, and you look at it, and you engage in it very intently. And the mind drifts away, you start thinking about what you're having for dinner tonight. And you say, oh no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm focusing on this issue, you know, this question. And there's ways of doing that for personal concerns. There's also ways of doing that for deep Dharma insights. Can we actually think about some of the teachings of the Buddha, for example? Do a deep reflection about the theme of impermanence, or about death, or about you know, a number of things, about self, what is the self? And it can be very, very productive, very, very, very profound to do that kind of reflection. The problem with teaching it to Westerners is that Westerners are predisposed to think so much already, that it sometimes it can get carried away and not be so useful. And so usually I think most of the Western Dharma teachers have really mostly emphasized the other side of, the other kind of meditation that's focused much more on non-discursive awareness. And it's non-discursive awareness is the one that really usually will take people the furthest in meditation. And so we don't teach that so much, but it's certainly a rich part of the Buddhist tradition, in many different traditions of Buddhism.
I don't know if it's useful, but even before I became a meditator, I discovered this when I was designing scenery, and I would be given the problem of designing a piece of scenery, and if I thought about it, I was lost. I was completely lost. So the procedure for me has always been do the homework, look, find out what the possibilities are, and then forget about it. And then the idea that you trust is the one that bubbles up from the deepest, quietest place.
Do you all hear that? Then one of the questions so say that you've done your homework, you've done your engagement, and you put it aside, and you're sitting and meditating, and poof, the idea comes. What do you do then? Do you go with it? Do you then start thinking about it and reflecting on it? Because the creative juices are flowing now, so, you know, the great American novel is happening. Or you put it aside for the purposes of your meditation. And it depends a little bit on what you want to do, of course. But there is a lost opportunity, I think. It's kind of like, because in meditation itself, when the mind gets quiet and concentrated, it can be very creative. And it's very seductive to be caught up in those creative thoughts that might bubble up. And it's fine to do that in a sense, but it is a lost opportunity because it's kind of like you're on a really good track in your meditation. Things are going really well. And some you're practicing really well. And then you take a detour that doesn't take you further in the meditation. And since you are on a good track, what would have happened if you just kept going along the track and gone further? Don't take that detour. Let those thoughts bubble up and then put them aside. Anyway, thank you for listening, and I hope that this was a little bit evocative of a possibility for you. And as you explore your meditation and your life and your silence, I hope that you have fun and enjoy it, and it brings you happiness and delight. Thank you.